Boy, we're going to be here all day. This is excellent. What's that? Oh, you know, all this is going to be kid time, because if you have questions, you can ask too, okay? So be so the first one, which is the most non-biblical one and probably the fastest one to answer, is where did the tradition of wreaths come from and why? And we talked about this a little bit when we were doing the lighting of the wreaths. It's stolen, like a lot of our traditions are for this time of year. Because there's so little to go on, there's nothing biblical about much of anything in our Christmas tradition. There's nothing about, and when we celebrate the birth of the child, kill a tree and stick it up and decorate its carcass with things. You put beautiful red and green things around. So we borrowed a lot of our traditions, and much of it comes from Northern Europe, pre-Christian Druid and pre-Christian Celtic traditions. The thought of the wreath was, according to Jan Richardson, or some sources that she cites, in Northern Europe, when it got to be winter, the wagons came in, and wheels were very difficult to create, very expensive, and you didn't want those hanging out getting wet in the snow, and so those were brought inside. And part of Druidic worship was that of inviting the sun back. If you look at some of the Stonehenge and some of the other Neolithic buildings back then, were all based on knowing when the solstice was, when the equinox was, and when you got to winter solstice, the shortest day, well, you do a human sacrifice, and then that would convince the sun to start coming back. Christians gave up on human sacrifice, big improvement over the Druidic worship for some people. But what they would do was invite the sun to come back by putting out the symbols of life and light. And so evergreen branches that stayed green, spring-like all through the winter were a sign that was put on those wheels that were not being used, and candle, or in reality lamps, were put on as well to in the midst of the darkness to invite the sun back. And so wreaths, especially lit wreaths, became part of the Christian tradition, just as we did with Christmas trees and some other stuff like that. So that's a cool question. Why December 25th? Is that the date Jesus was born? Probably not. No one has a clue when Jesus was born. The closest thing to a hint, some folks say, is the shepherds out abiding in their fields, keeping watch over the flocks by night, which would probably put them during lambing season in the spring. But no one has a clue. We don't even know what year Jesus was born. When the calendar was created, according to one bishop, he was off by at least 4 years, and chances are Jesus was born in between 4 and 7 BC. So Jesus was born between 4 and 7 years before he was born. So that's a trick. See, it's a miracle. December 25th, there are two different explanations for December 25th. The one I heard a lot when I was in graduate school was... sounds like it may not be so accurate, but the popular piece was that when Constantine, who was the first emperor to embrace Christianity, or at least make it not illegal, was kind of happy that the Christians were a very sober people and much more concerned about taking care of the poor and about loving one another than they were about wild drunken parties, which a lot of Roman culture was into. And there was around the solstice, there was a big drunken festival called Saturnalia, and which was the winter version of Bacchanalia, and you might have heard of that word too. It involved lots of drinking, lots of sex, lots of rowdiness, lots of everything, and so the theory was that the emperor wanted something a little quieter to replace Saturnalia. So he said to the bishops, hey, you guys, we need something to be chill. And so they said, oh, we'll celebrate Jesus' birthday then. But it looks like... And then they waited 4 days to sober up and then do it, right. It was, yeah, so it didn't quite, but it seemed that it ought to be on the solstice, that if that made sense. It turns out that Christians were floating December 25th as a day since the second century, quite a bit earlier than that. And it comes down to something really basic, which is that the feeling was that if we know the day that Jesus died, on the 7th of Nisan, in the Jewish lunar calendar, which that the year that Jesus was born would have been, or the traditional date of Jesus' death would have been March 25th, would have been his date. That was the day that his spirit left the earth. So it made perfect sense for that to also be when the Spirit came to Christ. So that would be when he was conceived. And so the assumption, or the angel coming to Mary to say, hey, you're going to have this baby, would have been March 25th as well. And you go 9 months from there, and boom, it's December 25th. So it's more of a poetic circle kind of thing. But the actual historical thing is... take a guess, and it's perfectly valid. So, any other questions on? Did I leave anything out on that? This is awesome. Since Jesus came in such humble conditions, why didn't he come as a woman? That's actually a really good question. Because especially as depicted in Luke's gospel, think of all characters. Luke wants you very much to know what was happening in the world. He says it was in the fifth year of Emperor Augustus when Quirinius was governor in Syria, when Herod was on the throne in Judea, and here's all these bigwigs, here's all the movers and the shakers in the world, and God comes and announces to a peasant girl on the outskirts of nowhere. I mean, we're talking Nazareth in Galilee. From a Roman perspective, Judea was the edge of the universe. It was right before you get to the where all the barbarians are. Nazareth was in Galilee, which was the northeast kingdom of Judea. It was a place where there was revolution, there was people who were fighting against Rome, it was the sticks, and it was a little dangerous. So Luke is aware of all, where all the world's power exists. It's in Augustus, it's in Herod, it's Quirinius, it's all these big movers and shakers, and an angel comes to a peasant girl who is nobody in the middle of nowhere to say, this is how God's breaking into the world. When the birth is announced, does it go to anybody famous? Who hears the word that a Savior's been born unto you in the city of Bethlehem? Shepherds. Shepherds. These are people who cannot do anything else. If you're a shepherd, you do not have a skill set that is valued in town. You hang out either because you're the youngest kid in the family of farmers and you're the one who gets stuck with the sheep, or you're an adult and you have no other skill set. These are the poorest of the poor and the lowest of the low, and that's the ones to whom the angels come and say, go and see, unto you is born. So the question of why not as a woman is a really great... Jesus was a peasant. Jesus lived in on the outskirts of nowhere, was raised in Nazareth, which was so small that biblical scholars in the 19th century thought that the gospel writers had made it up, because it wasn't until the mid-20th century that they actually found remains of a tiny village in the right place from the right time. Powerlessness on all these different ways, except that Jesus was male. It may be that patriarchy is so powerful that even God can't overcome it. But yeah, that's a great question, because that would have been in line certainly with the way Matthew and Luke both are presenting how God is showing up in as powerless a way as possible in order to show the power of love and how it is more powerful than the power of coercion and might and violence. When you have Luke and Matthew showing Jesus as the anti-Caesar, as the anti-Herod, where the rules of the world are might makes right, that would have been also powerful. On the other hand, in the ancient Near East, a woman going around teaching, would not have lasted even 3 years. Patriarchy and violence are powerful. But I don't know why. That's a great question. Any other ideas why Jesus wasn't here as a woman? Hard to?
A following.
To get a following, yeah. Yeah, because everything would have been sexualized. Oh, you've got a bunch of men following you? Or a bunch of women following you. Then you're really dangerous. Yeah. She wouldn't have been able to go into the inner court of the men. Right there, yeah. You can only go in so far. I don't know if Jesus ever went. I don't know if Jesus recording going into that area either. He was usually in the court of the Gentiles when he was doing his teaching. So,
no, it's a great question too.
I'm sorry. Yeah, well, the assumption is any person who's going to come with any kind of possibility of making social change back then would have been assumed to be male. Yeah, yeah, even more so than now.
How old was Jesus when Herod died?
I'm sorry? How old was
Jesus when Herod died? Because Joseph brings him back. And
Herod the Great died right around 7 BC. So it would have been pretty very quickly after, according to Matthew's timeline. It would have been, no, Jesus would have been like just an infant. Yeah, one, two maybe. Herod, his son. Yeah, I do not remember. I don't remember when the son died. I don't know what year that was. I'm sorry?
How old was Jesus when Joseph brought him back to Egypt?
Oh, probably within a year or two. It was because Herod the Great died in 7. So, and that's around when scholars think Jesus was born as well. So it wouldn't have been very long according to Matthew's timeline. So. The place meaning truth on different lines of the virgin birth. Place, meaning, and truth. Those are good questions. Again, much of the New Testament's not aware of a tradition of virgin birth. Paul, if Paul was aware of it, he would have talked about it a bunch, because that would have been his whole thing is, Jesus was amazing and different. And but when he said, the only time he speaks of Jesus' birth was that he was born under the law. He was born just like you and me, he's saying to his readers. He's just an ordinary birth. So he's not aware of it. Mark's not aware of it. And John's not aware of it. So we have two sources we get the birth stories from. And frankly, they don't line up very well. It's pretty hard. You can't take the two stories and, well, I shouldn't say you can't. We do. We glom the two stories together every Christmas when we do a bathrobe play. We have shepherds and magi tripping over each other to get to this. And they don't. The two stories have to stand on their own. Because they come from two very different communities that were sharing stories about who Jesus was. So as far as scholars are concerned, the birth narratives are very late. One New Testament scholar who's on the conservative side of the spectrum says that in the Gospels, the birth narratives are not there in order to prove Jesus is divine, which is how we tend to read them as moderns. Because the writers and the early communities believed Jesus was divine, that gives us the birth narratives. Does that make sense? Because those are communities of faith saying, asking the obvious question in every children's question is, what must it have been like to raise the Son of God? What would that have been like? What would that mean for the world? And Luke's community and Matthew's community give us two different answers to what does it mean. And for Luke, as we've talked about, what that birth meant was God chose to come to the poor. God chose to come to the helpless. God chose to come as the most helpless creature that exists. There's nothing more helpless in the mammalian kingdom than a newborn human being. They can do nothing. How, that radical overturning of the world's ideas of power. Matthew, who's writing to a Jewish community, has a different framework, which is he uses all the ingredients of the story of Moses and the Exodus, and rewrites them. He subverts them to a story about how God is going to bring a new Exodus through Jesus, a new freedom, a new liberation. And so you have this escape. Egypt is no longer the place of imprisonment and slavery, but the place of freedom and safety. You have an evil monarch, not Pharaoh, but Herod. So there's a wonderful use of these old archetypes, but changing them a little bit. So he wants you to know that when God comes into the world, the powers and principalities shake in their boots. Magi come from hundreds and hundreds of miles away. Herod and all of Jerusalem with him are shaking in their boots. The world is afraid because there's another king, a true king. And so different symbols, different meaning. And I'm not saying you can't glom them together, but you have to do some real origami with the text. I mean, some things as basic as, what is Joseph's hometown? The answer is different between the two. In Luke, Joseph and Mary grew up and live in Nazareth. And in Matthew's gospel, Joseph and Mary grew up and lived in Bethlehem. They both end up getting back to Nazareth in different ways, and they get to Bethlehem in different ways. For Luke, we have a census that brings them there. Then they go back home. In Matthew's gospel, you have Jesus is just born, and then they escape to Egypt. They come back, and it's still dangerous because Herod's son is at least as crazy as Herod is. So they go up to go incognito in the witness protection program, and they found a town called Nazareth that nobody had ever heard of, and they go settle there. So the stories are different. But they're true. And we've done this before when we talk about the creation narratives, where there's two creation narratives, and they're different, and they're both true. Capital T truth, not small t truth. Small t truth is, if you had a video camera, what would you have seen? Capital T truth is, what do they mean? And what they both mean is that when God breaks into the world, God comes a certain way to say certain things and to mean certain things. It's good that we have two creation narratives, because we have one story of God who is this cosmic creating God who creates by word alone. And then we have this wonderful Adam and Eve story where God gets down on hands and knees and creates human beings out of clay and breathes life into them. Intimate, wonderful, close God you can create. They're both true. And no one story is big enough to hold those two truths. We need two. And I would make the same argument with the creations or the Christmas stories, is that the truth of how God comes to us, that truth is too big to be contained in one story. We find truth in both, but they do stand each one on their own. So the powerful truth is, God came into the world. And God chose to come among the poor. And when God came in, the powers trembled and continue to at a radical gospel that says love is more powerful than power. That love is more powerful than fear. That love is more powerful than coercion. And that ultimately is the meaning of the birth narratives. When I was in seminary, we had a lecturer come who was a pastor from a generation earlier. I think he got ordained in the mid-50s. And at that time, it was still a little controversial to share with lay folk some of the biblical scholarship that we learn about in seminary, which was not a radically new thing, but assuming lay folk can handle these scary things, was a little dangerous. And if you got interviewed at your church, a question that often came up was, do you believe in the virgin birth? He said the stock question for seminarians would be to say, I concur with Paul on the virgin birth. And they'd go, oh, okay, because Paul never mentioned it. But I believe in the truth contained in those stories that I continue to be challenged by and learn from. And I, like the folks who gathered the New Testament together, were perfectly aware that these are two radically different stories, and that's okay. It was only as moderns where we read the Bible the way it's not meant to be read, like it's a historical textbook. It's not a science book, and you shouldn't read Genesis like it's a science textbook. And the Gospels are Gospels. They're telling the good news. They're not a history textbook like you got in high school. And it's not a math book with the answers in the back. It's a living document that you enter into. So, all right. Am I fired now? So. The next two are much very spiritual, powerful ones. How can I decipher whether I am truly following God's will or my own selfish, stubborn will? Any guidance? That's awesome.
That's
a bunch of sermons.
We might have to continue this next week with no written sermon.
And we're going to just keep doing, there we go. Actually, that's one of the biggest things for any spirituality is, how do I know the difference between the voice of love and my own ego? Because my ego is really loud. I'm sure I'm the only one. That probably is the question in spiritual growth. Because it's really easy to mistake those. Nadia Boltz-Weber says that when that voice in your head is telling you to hate the same people you already do, that's probably a good idea that that's your own ego. She said, it's amazing how convenient it is that God always seems to dislike the same people I do. Isn't that awesome? It's wonderful. The conflict is when that other Christian doesn't agree with the people that I have on my list, and their list is different. We'll do that as another one sometime. What do you say to those of us who want to follow Jesus' teachings but can't believe he is the only Son of God, or maybe the only way? Might be another way to do that. When we are, the Bible calls all human beings children of God. The Bible also calls all Christians children of God in John's gospel. And then we have language about Jesus' only Son of God. Those are all great questions. But I guess the larger piece is, how do we be followers of Jesus in a multicultural world? What do we do about speaking of our own truth in the midst of people who also have their own truth? How do you all make your way through that every day?
The Pope had some interesting words that go on the news the last couple of days about this. Where he said atheists could go to heaven as long as they follow their conscience.
Yes, he did say that. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I think the previous Pope is going, oh, I shouldn't have. What were we thinking? I heard something back. Was there?
No, I just say the old Pope spinning.
Oh, yeah.
What's
that? Yeah. So it wasn't an encyclical. It was a conversation. So hard to know. Yeah, that is a great. We are in an era that Christianity no longer has a privileged place at the cultural table. For 1,500 years, Western culture has been, what is normal is the Christian church. And then we have all these other things, and we have...
That was here.
Here. Yeah, in Western Europe and, Europe and North America. It was normal. And when different traditions got together for conversation, it was a little dangerous because you had Christianity wanting to be nice and talk to Jewish folk and to Islamic folk and to Buddhist folk, but there was a power differentiation that was huge. And that's not real conversation. Now there's the level of conversation between different faith traditions is much deeper and more real now. Because it used to be, we have to find out how we're alike, and we want to all say that we're alike so it's safe. But the reality is the differences are a lot more interesting than the similarities, and that's where we can challenge each other and grow. And I guess bringing your own faith tradition to the conversation, being confident enough in your faith tradition and knowledgeable enough about your faith tradition that you don't have to be threatened by somebody else's and can say, here's where I am, and they can say, we're different, and you can say, that's awesome. I can learn some very cool stuff from your tradition. And here's mine. When I was in seminary, I was speaking with a Muslim student who was taking classes at the School of Theology, and he had just gotten into a conversation with a fundamentalist Christian on the T. And I was like, oh, that must have been awful talking to this closed-minded fundamentalist. He said, it was great. He actually was willing to talk about what he really believed. You liberals are like, oh, we don't believe anything really different than you do. It's all the same, and we all love each other, and it's okay. And he's like, I don't even know what you believe here at Boston University School of Theology, because you're so wanting to say, we're the same. We're not. Let's talk about what those differences are. That's cool. And I was really taken aback, because he was like, now I know some of the weird stuff about Christianity that I didn't know before. So I was like, oh, all right. I think a lot of us are so unsure about where we are ourselves that when someone speaks from a different tradition or no tradition, we get really reactive because we're not sure about where we're at. But one place we do, where we can get together, is working in a world that is broken. And Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism and Christianity and Judaism are all about showing our faith by living it out in love for our brothers and sisters in a world that is broken. We have different stories about why it's broken, and we have different stories about what the ultimate ending is going to be. But in the meantime, there are the hungry to be fed, and there are the thirsty to be given drink, and there are the naked to be clothed. Justice, mercy, compassion. Those are all adjectives that Islam, Judaism, and Christianity use to describe God. And in Buddhism, you describe how it is we're to live in the world. So they're brothers and sisters with different stories, but we all have work, the same work that God calls us to do. I do that because I follow Jesus. And I'm confident in that, and I'm sure of that. And if you are doing that because you're following the teachings of Islam, amen. Grab a shovel, get a hammer, get a spatula, and let's do it together. We filled up the time already.